This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. 400 years ago today, that's December 18th, 1620, the Mayflower set anchor at what's now known as Plymouth, Massachusetts. At the time, it was called Patuxet. Now, for those who grew up in New England, the story of the Pilgrims, their journey on the Mayflower, their settlement in Plymouth, they're a childhood staple. You might even have taken a field trip to Plymouth Plantation, which is now called Plymouth Patuxet. Today, we're going to take a fresh look at that 400-year-old story. We'll look at how we have celebrated the landing at Plymouth Rock, the parts of that history that have gone largely untold, and we'll reflect on where this story fits into the sort of overall story of our nation. So let's begin, and we'll begin in Plymouth. Joining me now is Deputy Executive Director and Chief Historian of the Plymouth Patuxet Museum, Richard Pickering. Richard, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Richard, take us to December 18th, 1620, on the boat.
Today was a day that a small exploring party went out, and they were looking up and down for a final place to plant in the territory known as Patuxet. So if folks know a map of southern New England, they were actually moving more and more away from what is now Plymouth Center to what is Kingston, Massachusetts. But ultimately, they chose to settle on the site that is now Lydon Street in Plymouth, Massachusetts.
Now, you said final, and that's because they had already landed in Cape Cod and spent a month sending out these scouts, right?
There were three parties of exploration that set out from the anchorage at what is now Provincetown. Each time the men finding that either the soil was not suitable or they were worried about water supply and whether the water would be brackish. And on the third party, one of the sailors said, "I know of a place." And for me, that one is particularly dramatic because in their crossing from Provincetown to what is now Plymouth, the men were caught in a horrific storm. The shallop, the 33-foot boat that they were in, its mast shattered, its rudder broke. And one of the sailors was able to say, "Do what I tell you and we will live." And they used oars for a rudder, but they were almost drowned. They made it to Clark's Island. It was Saturday, the next day being the Sabbath, they rested. And on the Monday, they went ashore and they looked at Patuxet and in that moment realized that's where they wanted to be. For me, as historians, we always need to remember the human cost and the emotion. William Bradford is part of that third adventure. And when he returns to Mayflower in Provincetown Harbor, think of a young husband who's going back with wonderful news. They found a place to settle. And he climbs up the side of the Mayflower with this news only to be told that while he was gone, his wife had drowned. And think of how he himself was close to drowning and how he could imagine Dorothy in the cold water, losing muscle control and being pulled down by her clothing. We always need to remember the human moments behind the larger story.
Now, Richard, throughout the show, we're going to explore, you know, a full-bodied history here. And it was Patuxet, Patuxet, and there were people already on the land when the Pilgrims got there. But I want to stay with you for now, with the Pilgrims and the Mayflower itself. And, you know, one of the things that they are storied for is this document that they signed, 200 words, the Mayflower Compact, before they settled. Tell us briefly about what it was and how it impacted that settlement.
I think that Mayflower in recent decades, the Mayflower Compact has been diminished in its actual importance because of the fact that the language of the compact and the language of our Constitution are dissimilar. But I see the Mayflower Compact as unleashing incredible creativity and experimentation in self-government. And when Mayflower ended up having to remain in New England outside the legal boundary where their patent from the king had allowed them to plant, which is current day Manhattan, there were mutinous speeches and carriages among some of the passengers who said, we are no longer bound together, we can go off and do what we want. And it was decided that before anyone set foot ashore, the men representing either themselves or the entirety of their households would agree to a covenant that held them together and allowed them to build institutions. In the moment, I do not think they understood how impactful the document would be, but over time, as they began to see what they were doing, creating different institutions and legal practices, later on in life, William Bradford, when he returns to telling the story of Plymouth in his Chronicle of Plymouth Plantation, as he starts volume two, he said, I need to back up. In volume one, he'd already gotten them to Plymouth. But when he picks up the pen years later, he says, I need to tell you about this thing that we did. And he says it was a more sure and certain form of government than a patent because it was self-government.
All right. So briefly, and then I want to talk about how the museum tells the story a little, but briefly, is it accurate to say that the people on the ship were seeking religious freedom, or is it more complicated than that?
Many of those that were aboard the ship were seeking freedoms to worship as they wanted. They were trying to get away from the others. They didn't yet have that larger concept of freedom of religion as we have it now.
All right, so I'm going to play some sound for you now because I want to talk about how the museum presents this story and brings it alive for people. We spoke to one of your colleagues, Malka Benjamin. She's an associate director for interpretation and training at the museum. She spent a number of years portraying pilgrims, and she talked about visiting what was then Plymouth Plantation when she was six.
I still remember walking into a pilgrim house and feeling a little uncomfortable because it is a really weird experience the first time you go and, you know, you feel like you're walking into someone's house. But this pilgrim lady asked me to help her dry her dishes. Now, would I ever volunteer to help like dry dishes at home? No. But, you know, doing it in a pilgrim house made it super cool. And I went back later in that day, found the same woman, and she gave me another job. I got to crawl into this little chicken coop and get the eggs out. They were still warm. That's an experience growing up in the suburbs I had never had. And something about that moment, that visit, really flipped a switch in me. And that moment, that experience I had as a six-year-old, informs everything I do today in my role at the museum.
Is that the experience that you want visitors to have?
It is. And I have to say, I had the honor of playing Malka's father when she started as a child volunteer. I was her first pilgrim role player father. And I have watched her grow into one of the most masterful historians that I've ever seen, because she brings history to life in compelling ways so that as you are drying your dishes with Malka, she is telling you stories of her character's life, her character's belief, her character's losses and aspirations. And it's compelling because the people that are played by the living history educators all once walked the face of the earth. Not one of them is fictional. Not one of them is composite. And so what we are trying to do is give people access, as much as the accuracy allows us to do, to be in another person's historical space.
So Richard, later in the show, we're going to talk to a historian who is a member of the Aquinawampanoag tribe. Let me ask you, though, how does the museum itself present the history of the Wampanoag and Native people in Patuxent, and the story of what happened to them when the pilgrims came, pilgrims did?
We have one of the oldest Native studies programs in the nation. It's going to celebrate its 50th anniversary in 2023. And so for decades, the museum has been moving toward that story that these communities are living face-to-face lives. They are not separate. And the archaeology that the museum has done with UMass Boston is showing the proximity in the early years, that they're only feet apart from each other. And in the early years, it is likely that Usamequin, his people, are planting on the other side of Town Brook. So they're seeing each other every day. And it's one of the reasons that we chose in 2020, after much introspection, to change the museum's name to Plymouth Patuxent Museums so that both of those stories occupy the space and that our guests understand it is still Patuxent for Native people. It is still Patuxent. And it was not Plymouth until 1614 after Captain John Smith's mapping voyage. And so we need to think of the constancy of the Native experience, their survivance over time, their coming back from the tragedies of the 17th century, that all of these are layers like archaeology, and every life needs to be recovered and every voice needs to be listened to.
You know, I'm listening to you and I'm thinking about sort of 2020 as this line of demarcation in so many ways. And one of those ways is how we are telling ourselves our history. You know, this is the, we are grappling with our racial history, our ethnic history, our economic history. What else in the next era of the Plymouth Patuxent Museum? What other stories do you want to bring forward further? What else needs to be told? And how do you imagine you'll be telling this story 100 years from now?
Well, in the last 4 years, we've been working with a number of Native and colonial scholars on a project we're calling Along the Shores of Change. And that's a phrase that we got from Linda Coombs, who was on the museum staff for many years. And Linda
talked about... She's the one we'll speak with later in the show.
Linda's wonderful. And looking at the landscape as a place of change over time, so that going beyond the early years, those first 10 years of English presence, 1620 to 1630, moving out across, picking up the stories of King Philip's War, the museum has had a two-character play built around King Philip's War and the experience of Song Squaw, Awashonks, and Benjamin Church that we have done throughout New England and even at the United Nations. So these are stories that the museum's been telling for years, but we need to go deeper and diversify the number of stories being told.
What are you most excited, excuse me, for people to encounter when we can have full live encounter experiences again?
To be able to handle history, because part of the experience of being at Plymouth is not just speaking to someone, but being able to do the work, to touch a fur, to feel the fabric, to stir a pot. Right now, we were able to open in June, moving all of our staff outside masked and for the first time wearing microphones so that they could be understood from a distance. But the fact that you couldn't invite guests to work with you and do things with you or hand them a book that they could read from, we're looking backward, we're looking forward to being able to do what we once did, which was much more activity and not just talking.
Well, that is Richard Pickering, Deputy Executive Director and Chief Historian of the Plymouth Patuxent Museum. Richard, thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Great to have you. Okay, so in normal times, which these aren't, a 400th anniversary would be a really big deal. Plymouth had planned events commemorating the 400th throughout 2020. Many had to be canceled or they were moved to a virtual event due to the pandemic, which means that a year that should have brought a lot of tourism and the money that comes with that to Plymouth didn't. So what kind of impact did that have? Joining us now is Lee Filson, Executive Director of See Plymouth and the former Governor General of the General Society of Mayflower Descendants. Lee, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be with you.
So Lee, how long had businesses, organizations, nonprofits, cultural institutions been planning for the 400th anniversary commemoration?
Well over 10 years. everyone has been planning and doing all sorts of things to get ready. There has been infrastructure done to the town of Plymouth. There have been people that have ordered lots and lots of merchandise that would help people have collectible items to remember Plymouth. And so you can only imagine what a devastating year it's ended up being for Plymouth.
So, Lee, when you talk about all the merchandise, you know, I'm imagining boxes full of T-shirts and coffee mugs and baseball caps. What is some of them that may never get opened and may never be worn mm-hmm. or sold? But what is something we might not imagine that the businesses and community organizations have lost by not being able to mark this year in the many ways that were developed during that decade of planning?
Well, Plymouth is America's hometown, and with that title comes a great deal of pride and a great deal of appreciation of the place that we all live upon here in Plymouth. And so you can imagine, for all of these years, everyone has been planning. Everybody is so anxious to be able to tell the Mayflower story and to have people come and be in the authentic place where it all happened, and to walk up Lydon Street. All of those feelings together create so much of a bond with people here that I think that probably it isn't just those things that you've lost monetarily. It truly is the loss of the year that you had planned to celebrate. But I say that with by saying also that all of us know here that the Pilgrims landed in December, and most of the Mayflower story was played out in 1621. And of course, 1621 is the 400th anniversary of the first Thanksgiving. So many, many people are now just kind of pivoting, and they're all going to continue to do some of the same things, but do them in 21 instead.
So, Lee, I mentioned that you're a descendant of, people who came off the Mayflower. Tell us about how you first discovered that and what it means to you.
Well, I first discovered it because my grandmother, who we always called Meemaw, got together with her three sisters and started doing genealogy and stumbled across it. And none of them lived to really find out that it was actually true. They talked about it a great deal. And when they passed, my mother and I decided to pursue it further, and we went and did a little bit more research, and we did applications and found all the documentation, and lo and behold, our family had 8 different people on the ship through different family lines.
Tell us about one of those people who captured your imagination.
Oh, gosh, I wish I could tell you about all of them. Isaac Allerton, was the country's first entrepreneur in many ways, was one. But I think probably the most colorful is Stephen Hopkins, because Stephen Hopkins first came on the Sea Venture and crashed and then ended up in Jamestown for a few years, then went back to England and then traveled on the Mayflower and became a very valuable person to the group of Mayflower descendants as they created a new home here in the New World.
So, Lee, do you feel like you have any special role or responsibility today as a descendant of those Mayflower passengers?
Oh, gosh, yes. I feel a tremendous responsibility. I really believe that the Mayflower story is a story that all Americans should learn, because while they may be my lineal ancestors, the truth of the matter is they're America's family, because they were the very first families to come to America and settle as families. I feel a huge responsibility to tell that story and tell all of the story, including the story of Patuxet.
And tell me, what do you think the story of Patuxet is, briefly?
Well, the story that we concentrate on in Plymouth is what happened during the colonial times that the Pilgrim lived here and were here. And they were later on swallowed up, of course, by the Massachusetts Bay Colony. But for that period of time that it was Plymouth Colony and they lived here and they did, as Richard said, work side by side with the pilgrims, the Patuxet tribe, I think, is one that no one really knows about. So in other words, I guess what I'm trying to say is that this is the first time that we're really hearing the voices of people from the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe who now represents those who had lived in Patuxet. And it's interesting to hear both stories now being told.
And that is Lee Filson, Executive Director of Sea Plymouth and the former Governor General of the General Society of Mayflower Descendants. Lee, appreciate you being with us. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
As New England commemorates the 400th anniversary of its arrival in Patuxet, now known as Plymouth. Before the break, we visited the Plymouth Patuxet Museum, formerly known as Plymouth Plantation. Later in the hour, we will try to situate the Mayflower Landing in the larger American colonial story. Now, though, we want to explore what a complete truth-telling of the Mayflower story would mean. We're going to hear from Linda Coombs, who is part of the Aquinnah Wampanoag tribe. She's a tribal historian and independent scholar, and she worked for 30 years at the Plymouth Patuxet Museum. She's also a Plymouth 400 Incorporated board member. Linda, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I appreciate you joining us, and we're going to open up the phones to callers here. So, listeners, what is in your mind as we mark 400 years since the Mayflower arrived in then Patuxet, which became Plymouth? Did you visit the Plymouth Patuxet Museum? Are you telling yourself a different story now than you did in your childhood? And how should we be marking this 400th anniversary? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, Linda, the Plymouth 400 Board made clear that this is not a celebration. This is a commemoration. Why is that distinction important, and what does it mean to you as a member of the Aquinnah Wampanoag?
Well, what it means is that, I mean, other anniversaries of the landing of the Mayflower have been put on as celebrations, and what gets left out of that story is the Wampanoag people, because the Mayflower sailed into Patuxet. That's the village space that they landed in, but they sailed into the territory of the larger nation of Wampanoag people, which had 69 villages at one time, of which Patuxet was one, okay? And even though we had suffered a huge plague and had lost, you know, a greater percentage of our population, there were probably, we estimate, 20,000 people or so still left in the Wampanoag nation. So.
And the losses from that plague, Linda, tell us a little bit more about that, because it was a massive loss.
Yes, it was massive, and it often gets construed that we all died out, which was not the case. Entire villages were lost, and, you know, if there were any survivors, they moved to other villages, but there's no record that exists of that. But there still were many intact villages, like south of Plymouth, I think on the western edge of Wampanoag country, which is on the eastern side of Narragansett Bay, that remained intact. And even though we had lost a lot when the Mayflower landed, I think that people were kind of in the process of trying to reformulate and regroup, you know, from, because the plague was 16 to 18, so...
In reading an interview with you, Linda, in preparing for this, one of the things that you pointed out that was just so striking to me was there was this massive loss of life that the pilgrims, you felt, construed as I'm almost uncomfortable saying it, as God clearing the path for them.
There were different people, John Smith, Nathaniel Morton, I think, you know, various people authors who wrote things, and they did say that this cleared the land for a better people.
That's got to be painful.
Yes, absolutely. It is. Because that type of thinking, you know, kind of, you know, in a way set the stage for Wampanoag and, you know, subsequently other indigenous people becoming invisible and being discounted, and, you know, and all that sort of thing. So.
Linda, I'm just going to put the number out to our listeners and invite them to join this conversation again, 1-800-423-8255. What are you learning and what have you learned about the journey of the Mayflower, its landing here, the Patuxent community and now Plymouth? How are you thinking about it in this unprecedented 2020 we're living through? So join the conversation. So Linda, tell us about some of the first interactions between Native people and the pilgrims who were on the Mayflower when they began to settle in, again, what was then Patuxent.
Well, the village of Patuxent was one that was, as far as we know, entirely wiped out, with the exception of Squanto. And he survived because, by virtue of having been kidnapped back in 1614 and taken to England and sold into slavery. And 5 years later, in 1619, he managed to, you know, get passage back here, and he found his entire village just gone. He was looking literally at bones strewn all over the ground, because when this, you know, illness hit a particular village or area, people got sick so fast and died so fast that there was no one to care for the sick, no one to bury them. So it was all right there, you know, when the Mayflower pulled up. And then it was 6 months before any Native people contacted the English. And the first person was a man named Samoset, who was actually Abenaki. He was a chief, I believe, that used to just come down to this area and visit. And I'm not sure how he was the one who got to go into the English village the following March and see what they were about. But that is what happened. And he and then with Squanto ended up arranging a meeting with Usamequin and, you know, and the English leadership, which resulted in an alliance of mutual protection.
With Massasoit, yes, the chief of the Wampanoags? And was what were the characteristics?
No, wait a minute. Massasoit was not the chief of the Wampanoags. He was the chief of the Pokanoket.
Thank you.
One village.
I'm learning so much.
One village of the Wampanoag Nation, okay?
Okay.
And he often gets construed as being the chief of the Wampanoags, but he was a very well-respected, very influential, and very loved leader, and which I think is what, you know, people said, you know, Massasoit's the guy that needs to go to Plymouth, because there was the villages in between. Pokanoket is where, you know, on the western edge of Wampanoag territory, where Warren and Bristol, Rhode Island, are today. And he got the job because of his, you know, the nature of his character and the experience that he had to come out and see what the English were about and to establish the relationship that he did with them.
Linda, we talked at the beginning of the show. I think you heard our conversation with Richard, and one of the things we talked about was the Mayflower Compact, which gets taught in history classes as a set of rules that governed life on then Plymouth Plantation. It's often spoken of as, you know, a pioneering document in self-governance, and yet self-governance was already, the Native peoples here on the continent already had very sophisticated systems of self and tribal governance. So is it fair to say? Yeah, so go ahead.
No, finish your question.
So is it fair to credit the Mayflower Compact as being as pioneering as it often is in history classes as self-governance?
I don't think so, because it may have been pioneering for the English people, but that's only part of the story. The other part is the fact that the Native nations here had very formal types of governance. It varied from nation to nation, you know, but we did have very, you know, structured and formal type of government that worked. It worked for thousands of years, thousands and thousands. And that has all been not told and been discounted. We've been, you know, portrayed as like just randomly being here, happenstance way of life. We're lucky if we caught a deer when it was running by, and, you know, all of this sort of thing that just discredits, you know, and builds a lack of ignorance as to what our true culture and governance was actually like.
So I want to look at our understanding of the Wampanoag people today, too. We had a chance to speak with Darius C. Coombs, director of the Wampanoag and Algonquin Interpretive Training. He's a member of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe. I think he's your brother-in-law, yes?
Yes.
Okay, and he talked to us a little bit about why all of the pilgrims are reenactors, but not those who represent the tribe. Here he is.
If we're down there dressed up in skins and our traditional clothing, no matter what, if we have that on or we have a pair of jeans on, we are still the people, you know? We don't shut off at 5, turn on at 9, and that's the biggest difference right there. And a lot of people don't realize that. They come on down to the Wampanoag home and say, wow. A lot of things they first say is, I don't think you guys are still around anymore. And we're still here.
You know, I was struck, Linda, at the beginning of our conversation when you talked about how many people think that members of the Wampanoag tribe are gone, which I imagine, again, is quite painful. How important is it to bring the current tribe members an awareness that this is 400 years later, a living community of people, not a piece of history?
It's extremely important, just by virtue of the fact that we are a group of human beings that are still here. And the history that happened with our tribe, with the Mayflower coming in and the English settling in our territory, that's pivotal and foundational to American history. And everything that's associated with it, if it happened, it deserves to be told. History deserves to be told as it happened, you know, good, bad, ugly, indifferent, in its rightful context. Okay, and, you know, there's so much in the telling of history where that just doesn't happen. And you end up with the mythology or the complete misinformation, the complete lack of understanding that comes, or just, as Darius just said, you know, people don't even think we're still here. And yet,
Linda, I want to grab one call. We've got a caller, Marcus from Cambridge. Marcus, go ahead.
Yes, you just described the Wampanoags watching the Mayflower come in. Last year I went to the Wampanoag, the powwow in Mashpee Wampanoag, also the Nipmuc, the Narragansett, and the Pequot powwows in anticipation of this year. And I was anticipating, as were many of us, of watching the Mayflower sail rather than putter into Plymouth Harbor. And I'm hoping that next year, perhaps at Thanksgiving, we will be able to witness that with the Wampanoag reenactors watching the Mayflower come in and the New England reenactors creating New England. And hopefully in 10 years, like to throw the idea out there of having both the the enormous 13 ship Great Migration come in with the Mayflower, the Godspeed Discovery, and Susan Constant from Jamestown, the Maryland
Marcus,
Doug from St. Mary's City.
Marcus, I'm going to take it back from you there. I think we get the idea of what your call is. And there's a piece I want to bring back to Linda. So Marcus is talking about what he'd like to see, but he referred to the Wampanoag as reenactors. I think Darius was telling us that's an important distinction, not reenactors, people who are here now.
We are
so talk
Wampanoag
just a little
people.
More about that.
I mentioned earlier that we originally had 69 villages in our nation, many of whom were, you know, lost in the plague. And over the following four centuries, between 1620 and now, there's a ton of history and the process of colonization that happened where the English were imposing certain types of things on us to change us. I'm kind of struggling with how to make a very long story, you know, into a sentence here. But and as a result, you know, the communities that we had, some were on the traditional place where they always had been, some were not, and they had different functions because of the changes that the English brought. But, you know, so over the years, you know, many of these people or these villages just kind of went away. Either people moved out, or they simply died out, or there was intermarriage, and the tribal group just went away, you know, in all any of those ways. So today we have three remaining historic Wampanoag tribes. The Mashpee Wampanoag on Cape Cod is the largest, Aquinnah Wampanoag on Martha's Vineyard, and then the Herring Pond Wampanoag people in South Plymouth and Bourne. So, and we number 5,000 to 6,000 people in total, you know, which always strikes me because I know that in the United States, there's like 10 million Mayflower descendants, you know, so.
Wow, Linda. Well, that puts it in relief. Yeah. And I'm looking forward to bringing you back on the show in the future to have more conversations about this. This is a learning journey for all of us. That's Linda Coombs, who's part of the Aquinnah Wampanoag tribe. She's a tribal historian and independent scholar. She worked for 30 years at the Plymouth Patuxent Museum, and she's a member of the Plymouth 400 Incorporated Board. Linda, thanks so much again.
You're welcome.
We are spending the hour marking and learning more about the 400th anniversary of the Mayflower's arrival in Patuxent, which is now known as Plymouth. We started by considering what's been, for centuries, a national celebration of those events, and then we added a layer of truth-telling about what happened that has not been understood as American history, and that's changing. Now, for the rest of the hour, we're going to explore where this Mayflower-Plymouth, Mayflower Compact, where that piece of it fits in the overall colonial picture. Is it a story of firsts, or was this settlement part of a larger wave of change? We continue to welcome your calls. Have you been listening all along? What are you learning? How are you reflecting? What's challenging you today, and what else do you want to know? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our next guest is an historian specializing in early 17th century New England, Peter Mancall, a professor of the humanities, history, and anthropology at the University of Southern California. His latest piece is just out in Time magazine, as in, I think, yesterday, How America Keeps Adapting the Story of the Pilgrims at Plymouth to Match the Story We Need to Tell. Professor Mancall, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much for having me.
So what I'm just looking at the title of your essay. This wasn't a question I was going to ask you, but now I got to know, what is the story we need to tell?
Well, I'm not sure. You know, it's funny. If I was titling that essay, I'm not sure I would say the title. I would use the word we. I think we is actually a problematic sort of word. But I think the story that I tried to tell in that Time essay is that certain things happened in Plymouth, which your three guests, you know, just spoke about very poignantly. But, you know, Plymouth has a sort of supersized presence in the American imagination. And my essay sort of says, I'm trying to get at, why is that the case? And the point is, it's not obvious that this would happen. But in fact, Plymouth's history, whether it's the history of the Mayflower Compact or whether it's later histories from the late 18th century through the 19th and into the 20th, Plymouth's history and the documentation of Plymouth help feed a certain national narrative, a certain national script, which privileged the colonization of the English over the indigenous peoples who lived in the region.
And in your writings, you have talked about the fact that essentially the Mayflower, the Pilgrims, that whole piece of our history as it's been told, has been told differently over time to suit narratives that were politically expedient at the moment.
Exactly. You put that really well. Yes. So basically, you know, so English arrive in Plymouth. Your three guests just had terrific conversations about that. Then the story of Plymouth starts to circulate. It circulates through the 17th century, it's into the 18th century, and it keeps being revived. But it really becomes part of a national story during the Revolution, but really after the Revolutionary period. So on what we would think of as Plymouth's bicentennial, you know, in 1820, or its 300th anniversary, you know, comes in 1920. And what we see are different people, politicians, sort of well-connected historians, many of them, frankly, based in the Boston area, who sort of reach back to Plymouth and sort of see something specific that they think is important about the America that they live in. So in the 1820s and sort of heavily charged racialist logic and language of the day, you see people reaching back to Plymouth's history to sort of celebrate what these writers, now I'm talking about early 19th century writers, what they saw as the triumph of civilization over what they thought of as savagery, you know, words that we would not use now and we could sort of put in the rearview mirror. Skip ahead to the 20th century and look at the edition of Bradford's Up Plymouth Plantation, edited by Samuel Eliot Morison, one of Harvard's most famous historians for much of the 20th century. And Morison takes Bradford's history to make it more relevant. And he inserts, I put this in the essay, he inserts into it a running head, communism, right? So in this age of a Red Scare, when Morison is doing this, he's sort of saying,
I'm just going to time you out for a second, just for a second, because you're talking about Bradford and a restructuring of that. This is the same Bradford that Richard told us at the beginning of the show was the pilgrim who comes back to the Mayflower. He'd had his family on the ship and his wife has drowned. Are we talking about the same person?
We are. Well, that's an interesting question. We are talking about the same human being. And so what Richard was talking about was sort of the lived experience of William Bradford. But why Bradford is really known now is, yes, we know about his life. But what we really know is that he wrote the great history of Plymouth, which is called Of Plymouth Plantation.
This book
has been widely read for a long time. And so when Morison re-edits it, I should have made that clear, I apologize. When Morison re-edits it in the mid-20th century, one of the things that happens in early Plymouth, they have this idea, the colonists, that they're sort of going to share their possessions at first, called the commonality. They realize it doesn't work, and they move towards what we think of as sort of individual ownership. I think one of your earlier speakers said entrepreneurial spirit or something. Bradford uses that. Morison uses that. He doesn't change the text, but he basically hints these are the English rejecting communism. So he puts this word communism, not a term that the pilgrims would have used. And so he resituates a 17th century story to make it relevant for a 20th century audience. That resituating of Bradford's history happened again this year in a really wonderful edition of the book that was just published by the Colonial Society of Massachusetts, which sets up Bradford now in a context for readers in 2020.
So I'm going to bring a caller in here who wants to talk about another history book. We've got Suzanne on the line from Lowell. Suzanne, go ahead. Suzanne, do I have you? Okay, so I think we lost Suzanne, but I do know that she wanted to talk about a book by David Silverman called This Land Is Their Land. You know, what is the body of history that people would want to read, Peter, if they want to fully understand kind of our grasp of this piece of our history today?
That's a great question. I think if people really want to understand Plymouth, it's important to sort of take a step back from Plymouth, to see Plymouth as one place where English would-be colonizers encountered native peoples. And the English are not the only Europeans who come into the Western Hemisphere. So if we want to understand Plymouth, we really need to understand the European push into the Western Hemisphere, which begins mostly by Columbus in 1492. Because what Columbus starts in 1492, something that historians refer to as the Columbian Exchange, you know, sort of where Europeans inadvertently brought diseases and then learned about the resources of the Western Hemisphere to take them home. Europeans began to learn about the Americas, to define the Americas in a very specific way. This happens long before these people that we call pilgrims got on the Mayflower and went to Plymouth. Not only are the people in Plymouth aware of this deeper history, they're also aware of relatively recent English history. You know, I'm always sort of struck by people when they talk about the importance of the Mayflower Compact. As a historian, I'm not going to say it's insignificant, but I would, as a historian, I would also say it's not the birth of self-government.
A little more about that. I find this fascinating.
Right. So I wrote an essay, a month or two ago, you know, self-government is common in the Americas long before Europeans arrived. There's self-governing indigenous nations across the Americas, just as there are to the present day. And then, you know, the people of Jamestown are also not the first, your English to even practice what we think of as self-government. I mean, that would come as a surprise to the English colonists who were at Jamestown, you know, who set up what becomes the Virginia House of Burgesses in 1619, a year before the Mayflower arrives. So this idea, so then the question for us, for historians, is, well, why do we all talk about the Mayflower Compact so much? Well, the answer, well, you could say, well, it's important, and it does have a piece in American history. But part of the answer is because the Mayflower Compact is a 200-word document that has been structured into the way school curricula worked for 200 years. And so people sort of are told this is important. And for a long time, students were told this is the origins of the Constitution. Please.
So, Peter, there is, though, something, and we've got just a couple minutes left here, but there is something that does strike me about people on a ship as chaos is beginning to emerge and they're leaving their governance behind, finding a way to put 200 words on a piece of paper that provides them some safety and structure where they're going. There is something about that that is of note, yes?
There is absolutely something about that of note. My point is not to say that the compact is insignificant. My point is to say the compact isn't unique. The English had been trying to establish colonies and understand North America for two generations before the pilgrims arrive in Plymouth. And each of these groups of people, imagine, you're talking about what did they think about going on ship. Each of these groups of people as they're going across must be thinking, what are we going to do when we get there? We happen to have, thanks to Bradford, a copy of this document that we call the Mayflower Compact, which the pilgrims on board the ship signed. You know, so is it unique and original, or is it an artifact of, you know, what survives from the colonial period, what survives from the early 17th century that we have this document, which becomes embedded in Bradford's history of Plymouth Plantation and then stays alive through there? So I'm not trying to say it's not important. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
No, it's okay. Finish that up.
No, I'm not trying to say it's not important. I'm just trying to say, I think early American historians or academic historians, which I would count myself, you know, we try to see things in the context. I think anniversaries are very important for focusing people's attention, especially people in an area, and it brings attention to the past. I think part of what historians need to do is say, yes, let's take that energy, let's look at the past, but then let's put it into the larger context to explain things.
All right, so literally 30 seconds, the last piece of larger context you would have us understand.
Plymouth is important because it's a well-documented experience of an encounter between English colonizers and native peoples. Much of its history, as your previous guests have said, encapsulate much of what happens in the colonial era writ large. But it's very important to keep that wider perspective and to see it as an example, not to see it as just unique.
Oh, that is such a satisfying summary. Peter Mancall is a professor of the humanities, history, and anthropology at the University of Southern California, and author of a number of books, including Nature and Culture in the Early Modern Atlantic. Peter Mancall, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And that has been our special show for today on the 400th anniversary of the landing of the Mayflower. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, and then come back and join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.